فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة، والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A large crowd in southern Lebanon bids farewell to late Hezbollah leader Sayed Hesham Safiyuddin months after he was assassinated by Israel. Another Palestinian abducted by Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip dies due to mistreatment and torture in a regime jail. And the United Nations Security Council approves a resolution calling for the swift end to the war in Ukraine, with the U.S. and Russia hailing a move as a significant step towards peace. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. People in Lebanon have held a massive funeral and burial ceremony for late Hezbollah leader Sayed Hesham Safiyuddin. The mourners gathered in the village of Deir Qanun al-Nahr in southern Lebanon to pay their respect to Sayed Safiyuddin. They carried the coffin of the martyred Hezbollah leader to his final resting place. Representative from the leader of the Islamic Revolution also delivered a speech in the burial ceremony for Sayed Safiyuddin, vowing that Iranians continue to stand by the Lebanese people. Sayed Safiyuddin was assassinated in Israeli airstrike in October last year, just days after Hezbollah chief Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was killed by the regime in a similar air raid in southern Beirut. A huge funeral ceremony was held in Beirut on Sunday for the two martyred Hezbollah leaders. As Lebanon was holding funeral processions for Sayed Hassan Nasrallah and Sayed Hesham Safiyuddin, the pro-Palestine community in New York gathered to honor the two resistance leaders with heavy hearts. Rachel Hamdoun has more on the story.
Labbayka ya Nasrullah, or We are at your service, Sayed Nasrullah, were the slogans that echoed in the skies of Beirut and then later in New York City. Hezbollah chief Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, under whose leadership generations were raised, was honored alongside martyr Sayed Hesham Safiyuddin in a historic funeral in Lebanon attended by over 1 million people, as both were killed by Israel during the war on Lebanon as they fought for the liberation of Palestine. As the Lebanese held the funerals of the resistance icons on February 23rd, thousands of miles away, the people in New York gathered to participate to honor the martyrs at a vigil in Washington Square Park. There, physical and verbal threats by the Bitar Zionist organization failed to deter the unwavering loyalty to the resistance leaders.
We're gathered here to pay tribute and respect to a man who could not be tempted by any worldly pleasure and who gave his life for the Palestinian people. Here, I think it's the beginning to something beautiful, to recognizing someone who fought for justice until his dying breath.
In one particularly beautiful instance, the image of martyr Safiya Deen was covered momentarily by the Palestinian flag before reappearing as a picture of Palestinian martyrs Yahya Sinwar and Ismail Haniyeh, proving once again that the axis of resistance is bound by their love for Palestine.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah!
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah!
Was not only a great leader! Phenomenal human being! Military general! And martyr! But also an enigma! Whose humility...
Altruism and truth
have become the guiding light of the resistance in Lebanon,
Yemen,
Iran, Iraq, Palestine,
and beyond.
Sayyid Nasrallah and Sayyid Safiya Deen gave Palestine their all, from the beginning of their struggle in liberating the occupied lands until the day of their martyrdom. Israel thought that by burying the body of Sayyid Nasrallah under 83 tons of explosives, that it ended the resistance. But what it did not know was that it actually buried the seeds of resistance that will keep growing. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
Catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Gaza continue to claim more civilian lives amid repeated Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement with Hamas. According to medical sources, three newborn babies froze to death on Monday due to the severe cold and lack of shelter. The babies, who were less than 2 months old, lived in displacement tents in Gaza City with no heating. Meanwhile, Israeli forces continue to violate the truce by targeting Palestinian civilians and their homes in a number of areas, including the Al Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. Earlier, the regime's warplanes bombed the southern city of Rafah twice in less than an hour. According to health officials, five bodies were recovered from the rubble, while two Palestinians died of previous wounds. That brings a death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide to over 48,300, with nearly 111,800 others injured. Among the numerous infrastructures targeted by the Israeli regime during its genocidal campaign is a cultural center in Gaza City. The center served as a vital place for Palestinians' gatherings, hosting various cultural and social ceremonies. Our Gaza correspondent Ghada Brahim has visited the site of the targeted cultural center and spoke to a number of Palestinians there.
The more we walk and move across the popular streets of Gaza City, the more destruction unfolds. This place is Rashad al-Shawa Cultural Center. This place has been the inspiring hub of culture and educational gatherings in Gaza. Many art exhibitions, film screenings, and even school graduations were held here. This was a place full of life, youth energy, and inspiration. The Israeli bombs decided in November 2023 to mute it and to brutally turn it into wreckage and ruins.
The Israeli occupation targeted everything during its war on Gaza, everything literally. All the international institutions, healthcare institutions, and the cultural institutions were deliberately targeted by the Israeli bombs. This Israeli occupation wanted to obliterate the Palestinian identity. However, it cannot be erased from the hearts of our people.
The destruction of such a place asserts the idea that the Israeli regime is aiming at annihilating the Palestinian society with all its factions and social layers. It also aims at defacing the beautiful sites engraved in the Palestinian collective memory to punish the coming generations as well as the past generations without any military purpose, but just for destruction. The bombing and the destruction of Rashad al-Shawa Cultural Center, alongside with dozens of cultural centers across the Gaza City, cannot be separated from the broader context of the Israeli objectives of the war. which is to destroy Gaza with all its culture and social pillars and to kill any aspect of life for the Gazans. Ghada Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Well, now joining us with the latest updates on the Gaza Strip and the situation there from Gaza City, joining us is our correspondent Moti Abu Musabah. Moti, again, this ceasefire agreement phase two is currently on pause due to the Israeli entity not releasing the agreed upon prisoners last Saturday. So currently that phase is on pause. And in addition, as we are seeing, the Israeli entity continues its violations, continue to target places there, specifically where you are in Gaza City. Now we have three brand newborns, I mean less than 2 months old, dying because of the severe cold. If they had the humanitarian need that they need, they wouldn't have died in such cases. What details do you have for us there on the ground, Muti?
Yeah, first and foremost, let me begin with the horrific, the heartbreaking news regarding the killing of three Palestinian newborn babies in Gaza City as a result of the brishing cold, according to Saeed Salah, the medical director of the Patient Reference Hospital here in Gaza City, that those Palestinian babies were killed as a result of the severe shortage of the heating tools. They were living alongside their families in the makeshift tents. They were all displaced in Gaza City, and this reflects another horrifying side of the catastrophic situation that the Palestinian people are still living and going through, particularly in those tented camps. We are talking about tens of thousands of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian families, including the Palestinian children who are still living and suffering in their flimsy and makeshift tents in Gaza City. And as you know, for those Palestinian babies, they were not the first babies to be, as you know, died of the bitter cold here in Gaza Strip. They joined a long list of the Palestinian babies and children who were killed by the systematic policy of the Israeli occupation forces regarding that deliberate procrastination and allowing the humanitarian necessities. Let me remind you that during the genocidal war, at least 30 Palestinian babies and children were, as you know, killed by the bitter and the perishing cold in their flimsy and makeshift tents. So we are talking about a continuation of this abhorrent policy adopted and used by the Israeli occupation forces targeting the Palestinian children and the Palestinian babies in particular. And this is the normal result of having the kind of situation completely abysmal for the Palestinian people. And this is the real manifestation and materialization of how the Israeli forces are still systematically preventing the entry and the flow of the humanitarian necessities and needs into Gaza Strip, including, as you know, the heating tools and the gas that people need in order to survive the kind of situation amid these unbearable winter conditions. Let me remind you that according to the estimates that the last night was the coldest over the 20 past years. So this reflects how disastrous and catastrophic the situation is for those Palestinian people. Needless to mention that the Israeli forces and the Israeli regime actually is still deliberately delaying and procrastinating and allowing for the mobile homes and the caravans into Gaza Strip, which adds more layers of suffering for those Palestinian people. So I mean that this is not the last story for those Palestinian people. We are talking about more layers of suffering unfolding for the Palestinian people here amid the catastrophic consequences that the Palestinian people are still suffering from here as a result of the genocidal war against Gaza Strip. Regarding the Israeli brutalities and violations, as you know, those violations are still ongoing till this moment, because over the last night, the Israeli tanks mobilized at Philadelphia Corridor intensified their gunfire towards the Palestinian people. In addition to that, the Israeli helicopter drones dropped several bombs targeting gatherings of the Palestinian people in the western part of Rafah City. Moreover, the Israeli military boats also opened their gunfire towards the Palestinian people taking shelter in the western part of Rafah and Khan Yunis cities, respectively. So we are still witnessing these rising and non-stop Israeli violations of the ceasefire agreement. And as you know, all these violations make it very clear that the ceasefire agreement is still fragile because of the Israeli policy regarding maintaining those violations against the Palestinian people on the ground here.
Yes, well, I'd like to thank you, Moti Abu Musabah, our correspondent there in Gaza City. Definitely a call to all humanitarian organizations, the need, the dire need for humanitarian aid there in Gaza. Thank you again. Another Palestinian abducted by Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip has died due to the mistreatment and torture by Israeli forces in a regime jail. Two Palestinian prisoner rights bodies slammed the death of 35-year-old Mus'ab Hanihaniyeh, who was the father of a 9-year-old child. They said Haniyeh was not suffering from any significant health issues before his detention. Haniyeh's death has increased the number of Palestinian abductees dying of systematic torture in Israeli prisons since the onset of the regime's genocide in Gaza to 59. At least 38 of fatalities are related to Palestinians abducted from Gaza. The rights bodies voiced grave concern over the dangerous upsurge in the number of Palestinians dying in Israel jails. They said thousands of civilians are still languishing in Israeli imprisonment and are subjected to torture, starvation, medical neglect, and contagious diseases. Political analyst Sakina Datu joined us earlier to share her insights on this story. She says mistreatment of Palestinian abductees in Israeli jails is against normal human behavior. Let's hear more on what she had to say.
This is not just to say in the context of, because, you know, the Zionists are perpetrating these tortures against Palestinians, but genuinely, psychologically, if you study not just those in power and those in the IDF and IOF, forces, but general local population, anyone who lives in Israel, at least the majority of them, their mentality and their psychology is really deranged. And there's a lot of discussion happening about, you know, what is it that makes people these kind of things? It's not a human trait. A normal human being has got a conscience within themselves. And it is not a common human factor to be conducting this kind of atrocities on another people. The fact that, you know, the population would defend something like rape of prisoners just tells you this society is really, really sick. I think what is missing, the missing link, is that the people are aware of the fact that the Zionists are really demonic people, but there isn't yet a system. People haven't found a way to take action against them. But sooner or later, this will happen because this kind of a society really cannot exist. If not from outside, they will implode from within because all the characteristics of these people are really sickening.
Well, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad has condemned unprecedented deployment of Israeli tanks in the occupied West Bank. It said the move is part of a major offensive by the regime to displace Palestinians and annex the territory. The Islamic Jihad said it is the first time that the regime has deployed tanks in the West Bank since early 2000s. The movement denounced Israel's new act of aggression, saying it is aimed at uprooting Palestinians from their land. The Islamic Jihad also slammed Israel for attempting to consolidate its military domination by creating settler corridors that separate West Bank cities and their camps. The comments came after the International Committee of the Red Cross expressed deep concern over the impact of Israel's ongoing military aggression against Palestinian civilians in Jenin, Tulkarem, Tubas, and other locations in northern West Bank. It said many civilians are now taking shelter in crowded mosques and schools and have no access to basic needs, such as clean water, food, and medicine amid the winter cold. The UN Security Council has adopted a resolution calling for a swift end to the Ukrainian conflict as the U.S. pushes ahead with its peace initiative with Russia. The U.S. drafted text was adopted with 10 votes in favor, while France, Britain, Denmark, Greece, and Slovenia abstained. This is the first resolution the UNSC has been able to adopt in 3 years on Ukraine, as previous resolutions were vetoed by Russia. Although European members of the UNSC did not veto the resolution, they criticized it for being too lenient with Moscow. On the other hand, countries such as China, Russia, and the U.S. have all welcomed the resolution. Please stay tuned for more updates. Goodbye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression. Even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Amid Western silence, the Zionist regime's horrific slaughter of civilians exposes the racist core of the project of liberal intervention. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, in Gaza, where more than 2 million people have been deliberately starved amid relentless Israeli regime bombardment since October 7, 2023, we have seen a campaign of genocide replete with sexual violence, mass graves, detainees paraded in their underwear, the bombing of schools and hospitals, and mass displacement. We have also seen the last nail in the coffin of the idea of humanitarian intervention and responsibility to protect. Given the unbelievable atrocities in Gaza, we can ask, was the notion of responsibility to protect always a flimsy liberal veil over the US-led military imperial project? If the project to normalize civilian protection in conflict was a genuine attempt to harness US-led military power for ethical ends, then are Palestinians in Gaza not human? The latest Israeli regime war on Gaza exposes the cruel ratio of Israeli militarism. Behind the Israeli regime bombardment of the tiny territory of Gaza lies a series of indescribably grotesque calculations about the value of Palestinian versus Zionist lives. Over decades of Israeli regime military occupation, followed by a strict blockade of Gaza, the Zionist regime government has built a comprehensive vision of the tiny enclave, amounting to what one analyst calls as close to perfect intelligence as possible in a modern combat environment. As a result of this near-perfect real-time surveillance of Gaza, alongside knowledge of the underground bunker network that Israeli regime contractors helped build, the Zionist regime forces know precisely how many civilians will be killed in each strike. With its acquiescence to such Israeli regime brutality, the international community has overseen the death of the idea of responsibility to protect in Gaza. Given this, how many Palestinian civilian deaths does the Zionist regime government deem acceptable in its overall military goal of eliminating Hamas in Gaza? How many Palestinians can be killed to secure an Israeli life? While the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has claimed that there is a historically low civilian to combatant death ratio, a 1-to-1, an investigation by the UN Human Rights Office into identified victims in Gaza found that the ages most represented among the dead were between 5 and 9 years old, and that nearly 70% of those killed were women and children. At the same time, Israeli regime officials have claimed that there are no innocent civilians in Gaza, that the entire nation is responsible for the October 7 Al-Aqsa storm operation, that Palestinians are human animals, and that Gaza needs to be erased from the face of the earth. Statements with clear genocidal implications. This brutality plays out in individual strikes where civilian deaths are calculated and authorized, such as the precision strike on Al-Maghazi refugee camp that killed 10 children who were playing football. Amnesty International referred this and two other strikes to the International Criminal Court as potential war crimes. Five adult men were reportedly killed in the strike on Al-Maghazi, resulting in a 2-to-1 ratio of civilian to combatants deaths, if it is assumed that all five men were resistance fighters. Amnesty's investigation, however, found that the men killed included a barber, a falafel seller, a dental assistant, a football coach, and an older man with a disability. Even if one or two of these men were also low-level resistance fighters, which is possible, then the ratio could be between 7 and 15 civilians for one combatant. This fits with Israeli regime sources stating that ratios of 15 or 20 civilians were permitted for one low-level fighter. The children's deaths become part of the cruel ratios of the Zionist regime's war. In one of the worst single strikes of the war, at least 120 Palestinian civilians were killed when the Zionist regime bombed Jabalia refugee camp on October 31st, 2023. More than half of the victims were reportedly children, along with 22 women and 7 civilian hostages. The strike also killed Hamas military commander Ibrahim Biari, with an ultimate ratio of more than 100 civilian deaths for one high-level commander. An Israeli regime military spokesperson said after the Jabalia massacre that the operation's military aim had been achieved. This appalling toll seems to corroborate information from Israeli regime military sources that civilian to combatant ratios of up to 100 to 1 were permissible for high-level Hamas commanders. In contrast, the U.S. military accepted ratio for Osama bin Laden was 30 to 1. The horrific war in Gaza over the past 15 months exposes the racist core of the project of liberal intervention, that the lives of Westerners and the political interests of the Western world will always trump black and brown lives in the periphery, no matter how egregious the atrocities visited upon them. The Zionist regime has showcased the cruel ratios of asymmetric warfare with its near-perfect surveillance capabilities, massive aerial power, and AI-generated targets, wherein Palestinian civilian deaths are precisely calculated and authorized prior to the deployment of force. These advanced capabilities have not yet enabled the Israeli regime to defeat Hamas, but they have helped to achieve the Israeli right aim of destroying the possibility of meaningful Palestinian life in Gaza. And with its acquiescence to such Israeli regime brutality, the international community has overseen the depths of the idea of responsibility to protect in Gaza.
IranRadio.ir. What you just heard was an IRIB English radio program. From Beirut.
Welcome. We continue our special live coverage from Beirut one day after the funeral procession of Hezbollah Secretaries Generals Sayyid Hashem Safiyuddin and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Umma's Master of Martyrs, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, was laid to rest here in this holy site behind us. However, late Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hashem Safiyuddin is to be laid to rest today in his southern hometown of Deir Kanun al-Nahr. I'm joined here by Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief, MENA Uncensored. Hello and welcome, Leila, to this episode. First of all, to analyze what happened yesterday, it was a very long day, as we were highlighting just before we started, full of multiple kinds of emotions. On a personal level, as journalists, we have to keep things as professional as possible. But of course, we couldn't maintain not getting emotional when we were off the camera of how like the crowd was interacting once the funeral found its way into the stadium, the Kamil Shamoun Stadium. The first glance was very, very touching. And the amount of people that were mourning, especially those that did not even expect that a day would come where they would meet their leader and would not be able to talk to their own leader, and especially the denial state that they stayed in for a very long time, more than 5 months, not accepting the fact that he's not there. How do you read this amount of masses that joined yesterday to bid farewell to their own leader?
Well, they added to the roller coaster of emotions that we felt as reporters ourselves. I mean, seeing the crowd and how they interacted and how they bid farewell to their leader that they had, until the last moment, a glimpse of hope that he might still be alive, and building it on his last speech that he will be the only one, like the tiniest, like the smallest circle that will be taking decisions would be him, and he pointed at himself. And then he tells them, what you see, not what you hear. And then suddenly it dawned on them. And the crowd was joyful to hear his voice because they had a playback of him saying, oh, beloved ones.
Yes.
And then crying. And I could hear people just like going, the big sighs. And then
some of them even collapsed yesterday.
Yes.
We've seen the Red Cross going in and
we
out.
We did see that.
Taking
we
a lot of
that.
People.
So people were basically, I think it finally dawned on them. But it made them more determined. And you could see it from later on from the interaction during the speeches that happened by Sheikh Naim Qasim and the speeches that were being played back via the speakers. Mm-hmm. And it was completely surreal. I mean, us as reporters, we couldn't contain our feelings as well. We have covered his news for the longest time. Some of us have covered his news since the day he became a...
And some of them were even inspired by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and that inspiration caused them to actually get involved in the journalism business or even become a journalist, just to speak about this great leader and to walk the path of that great leader, and also
to be able to resist
in that manner, in the words, not because that's the only language that they know, and they wanted to be part of this of this ideology, and this is the only way that they can be. So he played a very important role in being an inspiration even to these journalists. According to agencies, they highlighted or estimated the number of attendees more than 1.5 million yesterday. Was it expected?
Well, we were discussing it the day before, along with foreign media and local media as well. And some people were estimating it's not going to be more than a few hundred thousands because of the cold weather, because of the threats, etc. And some others were saying, well, we bet it's going to cross 1 million. Mm-hmm. Our primary estimates before we lost any connection, because once we went into the media, to the sports city, I keep calling it media city because of the media office outside. But the moment we got in, we got cut off from the world because of the type of pressure that you have, like hundreds of thousands of mobile phones using signal at the same time, and then the jamming for the politicians. Mm-hmm. So our estimates, the primary estimates, were 800,000 by midday. After that, people continued to flood from Bekaa area. We know that over 250,000 people came down from Bekaa area. So we easily crossed the 1 million by, let's say, 2 p.m. And then the funeral procession where people were walking and they were covering all the highway from both ends, from end to end and from one side to the other, it was definitely above 1 million.
And all the area here was secured around the stadium. However, people chose to come early morning yesterday, at dawn, even before that, at night,
people
just to find places in the stadium.
There were some
to be close to the grave. Yes.
There were some people who set up tents in nearby areas because they came down from south and from the Bekaa. Some people slept in their cars.
Yes.
They just booked the first seat in, as you call them. By the time we made it to the stadium, around 10:30, most of the seats in the stadium were already filled.
Yes.
The outside squares were almost filled, and the outside squares filled up to 40,000 people. The field in the stadium fills up to 20,000. That was completely, by 12 noon, it was completely done. Then you had like the what you call official delegations, like the 3-4 people coming from every country. Mm-hmm. That's different.
And the seats were booked.
And the seats, you have about 55,000 seats inside the stadium. Mm-hmm. Just the chairs alone, they were full. And then people started sitting in between the seats, like on the stairs. So I do estimate, like, inside the Media City and the squares, it was around 120,000 minimum.
Okay.
Just the sports city again. I'm sorry about that.
Yes, Shamkamisham own sports venue. Okay, taking into consideration that there were a lot of restrictions before that, and that's why the number is kind of astonishing, because with all the restrictions that were happening, some analyze that there wouldn't be a lot of mass, or we wouldn't find a large number of people attending. As you were highlighting previously, due to the rise in the prices of the hotels surrounding Kamil Shamaoun area, and also due to the rise in the tickets, especially those that want to come to Beirut.
Plane tickets, because there will be other people thinking that Hezbollah is selling tickets for entry for the sports city. No, plane tickets, you mean plane tickets.
Yes, of course, plane tickets, because there are a lot of foreigners coming to Lebanon just for this cause. And for sure they had to pay double the prices to come to Beirut. And even some local and domestic local politicians, they were criticizing the location that the funeral procession will take place. And they say, why this place? Do it in another area. Certain kind of restrictions were actually applied, but yet that did not stop the people or the participants to attend the funeral procession. And taking into consideration also the weather, it was very cold yesterday.
But it was sunny.
Yes, in the daytime it was sunny, however, the day before it was really cold, and throughout the day we had the moments where it was really freezing, but yet people kept that aside and wanted to come for that cause. Why, in your opinion, what is significant about Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah that everything is being neglected? And even if they want to, and even I heard someone saying, even if I need to come crawling, I will.
He was not only an inspirational man, he's imprinted in people's hearts and minds. They've known no one to lead the resistance but him for 32 years. It's really hard to actually imagine life without him. And they owe him a lot. Most of the southerners, most of the people in South Lebanon, for example, they owe him that in 2000 they were able to see their villages for the first time. They grew up away from their villages. The Israelis had occupied most of these southern Lebanese villages, and nobody was allowed back. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in the year 2000, 8 years after he became Secretary General for Hezbollah in 1992, they were able to go back. And this is imprinted in their minds. In 2006, it's also imprinted in their minds that he is the leader who actually beat the invincible army, supposedly, in the Middle East. And for 34 days, the Israelis couldn't do anything to fight the resistance or stop them from launching missiles. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, despite the destruction that we've seen this time, and the brutality and the monstrosity of the Israeli occupation, he was the only one saying no, and he was standing with a just cause, which is the Palestinian cause. Mm-hmm. Not a single Arab leader did action with words, combined actions with words. He was the only one who would, when he promised, he would deliver. Others, they would just talk that they're supporting a certain cause, or that they like the Lebanese, they like the Palestinians, but there's no action at all. Mm-hmm. So it's respect, love, getting used to only one leader that they don't know anybody else aside from him, and at the same time, he's their idol.
Yes.
Are you going to basically separate such people from him? He's from the people. He's a resistance. They are resistance. Resistance goes together.
Okay. And on several occasions, he expressed that love that he has to the people of the resistance. And one of the speeches that I heard yesterday, he said that when I see you, I give you energy. And when you see me, I take the energy back from you, just the same way that you're comfortable. Of course, here he was conducting this whole speech to the people of the resistance in one of the occasions, and making it clear to them that it's not only you that you're happy with me around. I am also happy when I see you, because I take all the power that I need from the people. However, Leila, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, if you want to look at it from a different dimension, he has a special connection with everyone. It's like everyone feels that he lost a father, his own father. It's not just a leader. Someone very dear and someone very close to them. The 14-year-old, the 13-year-old, the 10-year-old child, the elderly, the women, men. We're working in different fields. They all feel connected. How did Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah manage to actually reach to the hearts of all these people at the same time?
Well, it's very easy. He was genuine. I had the honor of meeting him before.
Personally.
And I sat down on July 12th, 2006 was the last time I saw him face to face. And that was the day that he actually held the press conference to speak about the two Israeli prisoners of war that they took. And I had asked him a question, and he laughed because my Arabic
was... What's the question that you asked?
My Arabic was broken. I actually asked him two questions in one. The first question was basically, were you contacted by any entity to facilitate negotiations to release the two Israeli prisoners of war?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And the second question was that, well, over the past few months, you tried to detain Israeli soldiers, and it failed, like two previous attempts. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that the Israelis are sending you eight soldiers to the same location, and they're lightly armed? Don't you think it's a setup? They weren't having a picnic, and the word I used is kazdura in Arabic.
Yes.
And he looked at me, and he like you could see his teeth when he was laughing. He was happy, but then he controlled himself.
Yes.
And then he's like, no, it was a hard work. We were monitoring it for the longest time. And thank God, basically, it was successful.
What did it feel like, you being in his presence?
You know,
or him being in your presence?
You know when you feel lighthearted and you go out and you don't remember anything from what happened inside, and like years down the line you start remembering all the details? Mm-hmm. You forget anything when he's there. You're just looking at him, and he's so genuine, and he's like, you feel at ease. This is the first thing that you feel like. It's not like you're afraid of him or anything else. He has this aura where you're comfortable, but you know that you're in the presence of a great man. And because he's genuine and he asks you certain things, and then when you're looking at him, he is concerned. He wants to know, right? And I think this is the connection between him and the people. People believe that he's genuine. They feel that he's genuine, not only from his words, but also from his features. You cannot hide it forever. If he doesn't like something, it shows on him. If he likes something, it shows on him. Mm-hmm. And when he's sad, everybody is sad around him. You get to feel it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, knowing this information will actually allow us to understand more why people that haven't met him, even those that did not see him, they still have the same impression as you're highlighting. It's due to the actions, not only his own presence. However, the word that we always hear from the people that we actually interview, what is like the most significant aspect that you love about Sayyid Hassan? The first answer is Sayyid Hassan boosts my morale.
He makes you
and
feel
this has a
invincible.
Lot of connotations. I mean, whenever you're sad, whenever you're depressed, whenever you feel angry, whenever you have you have that clear vision or clear image of how to read politics, of how to read the political developments in the area, then this man comes in, or this leader comes in, to give you a clear agenda of what has happened, what is happening, and what is expected to happen. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, there are certain people who are born with a special connection to everyone, and it's really hard to replicate them. Well, the whole thing in itself is aura and charisma, mm-hmm. and not everybody has it. You can be a great leader, but minus that charisma, people don't connect to you. It would be just like basically a school teacher dictating them something. With him, it's the genuine, like, he truly believed in what he was saying, and that's why you can actually believe what he says. At the same time, I don't know how to describe it. It's out of this. It's really hard to replicate him. It's really hard. I mean, like, he left some big shoes to fill, not only by whoever basically came after him, like Sheikh Naim Qasim, among others. And remember, they go in tow, they came together and they stayed together for a long time. But for all the leaders across the world, it's really rare to see this kind of specimen in leadership where he is close to the people. People love him, even when he's behind a screen. Mm-hmm. Like, there are certain times when he never appeared in front of people again. But people would still wait for him to appear on TV to listen
after
to that, to get the positive energy, to hear what he has to say, and because he was truthful. He never lied to his people, and this is very important. Even the Israelis, by the way, the Israeli public, I'm not talking about the Israeli media or basically the government, but the Israeli public used to wait for his speeches to make sure that their government is not lying to them. Mm-hmm. So his truthfulness is actually what also attracted people, and it added to not only his credible image, but it also added to his assertive manner that when he promises you something, it will happen.
And the most astonishing part is that there are no certain people that loves him.
Yeah.
However, everyone loves him. Coming from different sects, from different religions, from different ethics, from different morals. For example, also we actually heard the story of a man who was standing and he was screaming yesterday, saying that I am not a good person. I commit a lot of mistakes in my life, and I am not following the Islamic rituals or applying it the way that it should be applied. However, I love Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. And that by itself you cannot judge me on. I have the right to choose whoever I love, even if I'm not a saint.
Well, he didn't judge people. He judged actions. But at the end of the day, he's somebody that you'd feel he's forgiving.
Yes.
No matter what.
And we've seen people from different sects, Christians.
You would see it from the resistance.
Yes.
Forget anything.
They are all coming
in. From the resistance way of fighting. They always act ethically. They fight ethically. They don't target women and children. They don't target houses of worship. They don't target civilian areas. And the only time they targeted civilian areas is when the Israeli occupation forces were in those areas, taking them as barracks, right? And they took their own people as hostages, by the way.
Yes.
This is the Israeli occupation. So at the end of the day, when you have that resistance consistently fighting ethically, you know that they are being led by an ethical leader, no matter what.
Yes. But do you think that that openness among the people is the result of Hezbollah's involvement in the Palestinian cause? Because people can look at it from this dimension, that the Shias actually protected the Sunnis. So therefore, this group is open-minded and is open to all sects and do not differentiate. Rather, they deal with us as a human, and not to what religion we belong to, or what ethics and morals we believe in, or whatever facts we have in our lives. So do you think that that added up to this openness that we've seen yesterday? We've seen people coming from Europe, from Brazil,
we saw
from Algeria.
Jews and Christians.
Jews,
attending.
Christians, exactly. So do you think that this political involvement in the region allowed them to understand more about Sayyid Hassan?
It's not just the political involvement in the region. You have to understand one thing. They've been subject to Israel.
They felt comfortable.
But they've been subject for the longest time. They were subjected to a mass propaganda campaign against Hezbollah to tarnish its image since 2006 until
yes.
today.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans actually confessed. Jeffrey Feltman, the former U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, said, we've put in about $500 million to tarnish Hezbollah's image. And that image had brought into people's minds, it's Shia versus pitted versus Sunnis.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody likes each other. It's a very, very dangerous place. And the Muslims are out to kill everybody. The Shia, they don't like anyone. And then suddenly
because
you see...
Because they're trying to incite sectarianism.
And suddenly you see, basically, Hezbollah, which is mostly Shia-dominated, because they do have Sunnis fighting with them, and they have Christians fighting with them. By the way, this is something that most people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Standing next to the Palestinian cause, and some people were trying to portray it as an Islamic cause, and as a Sunni cause,
mm-hmm.
Sayyid Hassan made sure to tell everybody, it's not only a Muslim cause
mm-hmm.
or an Arab cause,
it's a humane cause.
Like
yes.
it's about humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what broke the tarnished image in the mindset of a lot of people, including officials, who some of them came to this
funeral. Is it clear to the enemies that this paper is burned by now, the sectarian paper? Is it? Do you think that they actually reached to that? Because they're playing on another card
right now.
It's
totally burned, and they're trying to do something else. They're carrying out with their what you call propaganda and smear campaign
mm-hmm.
and character assassination, mm-hmm. as you call it. But at the end of the day, people now know their ways. The thing is, they've taken to social media to try to spread that everybody hates everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But in the fact, it's two groups of the same Israeli entity and the Americans and
yes.
those who are helping them, just bickering among each other to insinuate that there is a bickering among the mass public.
Okay. One of the most significant scenes was the well-organized procession yesterday. This is an organization, a resistance group that has been out of massive war, demolished their homes, made them lose dear ones. They are broken. Their leader, top rank leaders, have been assassinated. Very sad from inside for what happened to his own country, but yet managed to actually organize a grand funeral procession, a grand funeral ceremony with this specific... we've seen what happened yesterday. Everything was managed in a perfect manner.
To the T, I would say.
Exactly, exactly. And in no time, only a few months preparations. Of course, here, if you may allow me, I have a lot of information. For example, to ensure the safety of the attendees, the Islamic Health Society has deployed 1,500 medical volunteers yesterday, including paramedics, doctors, and nurses, across 60 medical tents. Additionally, 100 ambulances have been stationed along the funeral route. In addition to how it was programmed, in addition to how everything was managed in a perfect way, of course, taking into consideration that we had an estimate of 1.5 million participants yesterday, but still, everything was managed in a perfect condition, in a perfect way. How do you view this?
I found it as a supernatural, not like human, like superhuman kind
but
of work.
What happened yesterday needs a huge government to actually organize.
It needs a massive security apparatus just to be able to contain and maintain the people, because any infiltrator could cause harm, mm-hmm. be it through a blast or creating problems on the ground, etc. But I'll say something that's based on experience. Mm-hmm. It happened to us as reporters. You remember that the media office received a massive blow when the Israeli occupation forces assassinated Haji Muhammad Afif Nablusi, who was the head of the media office, yes. for Hezbollah, along with several crew members, four of them. Mm-hmm. And so they lost a significant part of those who work as an organization, on an organizational capacity, mm-hmm. and on strategy capacity.
Yes.
Yet the media office was able to pull everything together, all the strings together, despite some discrepancies, and it wasn't their fault. And I was saying that basically I went down to the hotel to pick up my card for the funeral procession so we can enter the sports city, not media city this time.
Yes.
But there were hundreds of reporters who did not register online. They should have registered 2 months ago when they opened the door and they alerted everyone.
Okay.
They didn't register. They made a walk-in in the morning demanding cards. And some of them were, they had their cameras prepared and they started taking photos and they posted like, oh, it's not organized.
Okay.
The ones who were registered received their tickets. They're basically what you call the
order.
The press card, mm-hmm. because it's not only by order. There's a security element. They have to check your background. You have to present your picture and your data and your data.
For
your background.
Safety reasons.
If you come as a walk-in last minute to such a massive event, and they know anything about you, and most,
will not allow you in.
Most of them were foreigners. They were not Lebanese, mind you.
Yes.
So I don't know if you're a criminal. Maybe you're a Mossad. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that my colleagues are like that, but just in case, you have to understand the security aspect. And still, they catered to people. They told them to stand in line, and they gave them numbers.
Okay.
What did they do? They all heard, like, just like a large herd, just jumped together. They demanded the cards now. It's like, you can't get a press card unless you stand in line and wait for your number to be called in, and they will look into your details, they will give you that.
Okay.
So that pressure was, I do believe it was done on purpose so they can publish that kind of news. And the other media who had their cards, they just dismissed it directly. It's like, no, it was organized. We had registered before, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Our time is almost getting to an end. Leila, in one word, of course, after what happened yesterday, after the funeral procession ended, and this morning also people are still grieving. But however, how do you see what happened yesterday will reflect on the political situation or on the political stance of Hezbollah and the government?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The government will think twice before vexing that kind of constituency. Remember, they also had Christians from other areas coming over, mm-hmm. to show support to Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah,
yes.
and the resistance itself. And people were crying among them. Like, I have lots of friends among them who were crying. But you have to think about it from a different perspective. We're also approaching the parliamentary elections.
So they will think twice. Yes, exactly. Yes.
Next year we'll have the parliamentary elections, mm-hmm. right? And this tells the other constituents, the other political parties, if you don't unite with us or collaborate with us, you will be losing those votes.
Yes.
You have collaborated with us in the past and you received our votes. That's why you are members of the parliament now. But if you work against us, the best thing we have is like put our votes where they actually, people who merit them, and we will have new allies.
Yes.
And this will make them think twice of how
okay.
they deal with Hezbollah.
Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief, MENA Uncensored, thank you very much for joining us in this conversation. Thank you very much.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. The Quran, this great miracle of our beloved Prophet, is right before us. As mentioned in some of the supplications and dua during the month of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, we hope it will not testify against us for neglecting its priceless lessons. You are listening to The Viewpoint, hosted by your humble brother, Sayyid Ali. And I am here sitting with dear brother, Sayyid Zain. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Really good to have you here. And dear brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Good to have you here. The Quran is often referred to as the eternal miracle of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. Unlike the miracles of other prophets that were limited to their times, Quran is eternal. Quran is a miracle in various dimensions. Its language, structure, its unique narrative style, and even its prophecies about past and future. Can you elaborate one? Can you elaborate on one specific dimensions of the Quran's miraculous nature that particularly resonate with you, or is often overlooked? Like people don't consider this aspect of Quran as something miraculous, something interesting that should be, you know, given some look and thought on.
Well, the first actually specific or quite special aspect of miraculous aspect of Quran is the distortion that we have talked about a little bit. So to me, it is among the strangest aspects of miraculous aspects of Quran. Because when I'm thinking that how is it possible for a book, within 14th century stay unchanged and stay undistorted, it is really, there is nothing behind it except Allah's will and power.
It's like a God's life challenge.
Very true.
Yeah.
And this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself guaranteed. إِنَّا نَحْنُ نَزَّلْنَا الذِّكْرُ إِنَّا لَهُ لَحَافِظٌ. That is, we have definitely and certainly revealed the book, and we are its protectors. So he himself actually guaranteed that. When we want to even narrate a single word or a single sentence, if we want it to stay for, a couple of years or let's say centuries, it finds different formats of narration or formats of statements of that sentences, right?
Sure.
When we are working with a mobile phone, when we want to make it to factory set, so it makes us a sort of factory set.
Yeah.
And then we shall be apt to receive the benefits and blessings.
And it feels good to have that self.
Definitely. So all the malfunctioning aspects of parts of our life, or in every aspect, not only materially but also spiritually, will be remedied by this actually aspect of Quran. If we recite Quran, what do we mean by recitation of the Holy Quran? Is it just to recite it with a good voice? So though it is good, but first we need to focus on this recitation of 50 verses a day. So after that, in case we had the chance or we had the inshallah mood to recite more, even we can increase it to at least 6 pages of the Quran. But with focusing or reading the translation or even the tafsir or commentary of one single verse of those pages that we recite today, to see which one of these verses actually attracts our attention to. So at least we have a share of our we have a daily share of our portion of Quran's teachings for that day. So it changes the life of a person. Once I myself was working in the street, I saw Ayatollah Bajad in the other side of the street. I went to ask, please teach us something, tell us something. It was interesting that he recommended something very beautiful and very easy to me. He said, recite Quran more. I told him, okay, how? He said, just recite. I told him, tafsir, or do I need to recite or read tafsirs as well, or translations? He said, in case you had the chance or the mood, in case you had the mood or chance to recite the tafsir, recite the tafsir of Ayatollah Qarati.
Okay.
Then he told me, he referred to one of the tafsir that is available in the market, the tafsir of the exegetes and commentary of Ayatollah Qarati on the Quran. He said, that is very easy and very easy to understand. It is very very easy to be understood. Then I want to say that when you see a person like him, he wants to recommend you something that actually guarantees your salvation. He recommends you to recite more Quran. So we need. This is the way. This is beyond the. This is the mystery of Quran staying safe and undistorted. That it has been recommended within in the course of history by scholars and ordinary people or religious authorities, that they have kept all these teachings of Quran in their hearts. But recitation is good, then pondering on some verses is even better, and acting upon them is even much more better.
Thank you, dear brother. Dear brother Sayyid Zain, trust in Allah's promises is identified as a sign of true reliance and tawakkul on Him. This gets trickier during hardships and troubled times, because then we are giving a test, and we know that. And for those who are not a real believer like myself, it's hard to be patient enough and trust his mysterious ways of doing things. The question is, how can someone strengthen their trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's promises, especially during tough times? If you know any verse of Quran in that regard, that would be appreciated if you can mention it here.
First and foremost, I would like to correct you that, inshallah, you're amongst the believers. And
oh, thank you so much.
So yes, the Quran does speak about trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he gives us tests to be able to, you know, test that trust. And then if we are successful, then our trust in him and our belief in him becomes deeper. One of the verses that comes to mind regarding trust in Allah, it says, وَمَنْ يَتَوَكَّلَ اللَّهُ فَهُوَ حَسْبُهُ. That whoever has tawakkul, whoever relies on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will be sufficient for him.
Yeah.
So this, and there's many verses in the Quran that talk about tawakkul on him, and Allah loves those who do tawakkul. So Quran has a lot of verses on this. So one thing, though, I think that we should keep in mind regarding tawakkul is this idea that tawakkul doesn't mean that we just, you know, say that, okay, Allah will take care of it, okay, and I don't do anything. So that's the wrong idea of tawakkul. And tawakkul is a whole subject that you know, can go into. But basically the idea is this, that tawakkul, it comes after a person does his responsibility. Okay. So our responsibility that has been put on our shoulders from the religion and from our own reason, we have to do that responsibility. Okay. And then have tawakkul after that. And inshallah, then Allah will bring about good results in that. Right. So now when you know, the Muslim nations are attacked, the Muslims are being killed, you know, these powers are, you know, helping each other in order to oppress and take resources and, you know, all these different difficulties. If a person says that I'm going to do tawakkul, that Allah will take care of it and not do anything himself, well, that's not the right idea.
Yeah.
Okay. No, we have to step, we have to take a step, we have to go and do our responsibility, we have to fight the good fight. And we have to, you know, repel